It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
You're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland.
Hello. 1, 2, 3.
This is the battleground.
Hi, I'm Jeff Rosenberg. Tune in to the Song Circle every Friday afternoon at 1:30 p.m.
Turn their backs on the grisly scenes, traced to the privileged sons. And your death will come soon.
You never know what you'll hear next.
Check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip hop.
And I am Elizabeth Petito Martinez here with Hard Knock Radio. Oh, and you are?
I'm Yuri Kochiyama with Hard Knock Radio.
This is Dolores Huerta, and this is Hard Knock Radio.
You know you're dealing with the black terror, blessed Darth Vader. Only bite my tongue when I rock the cross fader. This is the grand verbalizer, fucking lesson, Brother J of the X Plan. Big up and respect to Hard Knock Radio.
Time's running out for the dream they chase. Longing for a past built on fear and hate. Whispers of glory, but the truth won't fade. The good old days weren't good for everyone's fate.
Time is running out.
America won't be great for those who hate our souls. Built on our blood, but they lost control. Now they weep for a past soaked in shame. But history will let them play that game. Ain't gonna be no good old days. Time's running out.
David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Over the weekend, it was supposed to be a festive and anticipatory one. I think I made up a word, but I like it. If you're a football fan, if you're a sports fan, this was the weekend in which we saw the NFL draft unfold, and there was a lot of talk about the son of Deion Sanders, Shedeur Sanders, who has sparked a lot of interest, has been a very successful college football player, and many thought that he would make headlines in being drafted. And what we saw unfold, which took over the headlines and became the dominant story of the NFL draft, was that he was reduced to being picked in the fifth round, and the word humbled and checking arrogance and all these sorts of things popped up. And we wanted to look at that, but look at the larger conversations around that. There's a lot of politics, a lot of layers and levels. And so I wanted to bring two gentlemen on who I think are equipped to break this down. The first is Dave Zirin, who we know from The Nation magazine. He writes the column Edge of Sports. He does the radio show Collision. He's done a documentary on the NFL and is a frequent guest on our show. He's no stranger. So, Dave Zirin, welcome. The other is a filmmaker extraordinaire, coincidentally, a former quarterback, which is one reason why I wanted to have him. And also, among his films, he's done a series of films or shorts that deal with black manhood, and I wanted to have him on. His name is Byron Hurt. I want to start off with you, Byron. As a former quarterback, this thing with Sador Sanders, what came to mind with this NFL draft?
Well, thanks for having me on, Dave, and it's great to be with the two Daves for this conversation. I was shocked like most people. I mean, I fully expected Sador Sanders to go in the first round, if not the early second round. I really fully believed that he would go in the first round. So when he began to slide, immediately, I thought about his reputation, how he is seen in the eyes of many in the sports world. And when I say many in the sports world, I'm talking about coaches, executives, people in positions of power who have the means to control his fate, as a football player in the NFL. I thought about the weight that he carried, being the son of the great Deion Sanders, who is now, who has basically created a major lane for himself as a college football coach and has done so very successfully. As a former black quarterback, Dave, it just felt very familiar to me. Just the sort of overlooking, this sort of putting a player in their place, so to speak, to let them know that they were in control. They being the NFL ownership, the NFL brass, they were the ones in control. One of the things that I've heard, people say is that, how could race be a factor if the number one quarterback taken overall was a black quarterback, right? And that, there was another black quarterback taken ahead of Sador. And I think that's not really a sophisticated, or nuanced approach to understanding how race works in this country. There are layers to racism, and there are layers to how white people view black men, right? And I think about some of the historical stereotypes that have been constructed about black men, from the coon to the buck and the mandingo and the field Negro versus the house Negro, and all of these historical representations. And I think that white people are experts at placing black men in very specific boxes. And I think that Sador Sanders fits into a particular box that separates him, that distinguishes him from other black men, he and his father. And so I think that those things definitely played a role in how this draft played out for him.
Right. Appreciate that. And I'm going to come back to some of the things that you raised. Dave Aaron, I want to bring you in on this. We were talking, and there's a lot of layers and levels with this in terms of how sports works, the owners. How do you see it?
Well, starting with seconding everything Byron Hurt just said. So rather than repeat him, I'll throw in a couple of new different angles on this. One of the greatest misnomers of sports history, as it's often told on places like ESPN, is that the media and the fans turned against Muhammad Ali when he joined the Nation of Islam and later stood up against the war in Vietnam, which was still very popular in the mid-1960s. That is such a lie, Davey. The media and the sports world, and I don't just mean the white fan base, I also mean a lot of the black press as well, turned against young Cassius Clay when he was just telling everybody how pretty he was, when he was telling everybody he was the greatest, when he was telling everybody he was the best of all time. And that started when he was 18 years old. So think about that. And I think a lot of it had to do with two things. I mean, I know for a fact it had to do with young Cassius Clay being a huge pro wrestling fan and seeing the way Gorgeous George could fill up a stadium by making everybody hate him. And he was like, ooh, I like that. But it also was because he grew up in a generation you know, through the 1950s, living through Emmett Till, who he thought he looked a lot like, and it gave him nightmares growing up, through his father, who was at least a loose adherent of the politics of Marcus Garvey and had literature in the house, and through also starting to read the politics of the Nation of Islam, like at that young age. I mean, he was somebody who they tried to humble just because he was a young, and I think young is a key word here, proud black athlete. They wanted him humbled. They called him Cash the Brash and Gaseous Cassius. And I use that template to say sometimes when we think about people being quote unquote blackballed, and my radio co-host Etan Thomas hates the word blackballed. He says white bald, but I'll just say blackballed for the purposes of this conversation. That getting blackballed, sometimes people think it's because, well, Colin Kaepernick took a knee against police violence, forgetting that people were already talking down Kaepernick when he was one of the first people with tattoos. You remember that? And was looking and flexing and looking all cocky. You see, for these NFL owners, being young and unapologetically proud, really, of who you are, but also being black, is political enough. You know, you don't have to raise your fist like Tommy Smith and John Carlos. If you are not humbled, particularly, and obviously this culture, I think, is profoundly more real in, say, the NFL than the NBA, for a host of reasons we can discuss, and particularly at the quarterback position, it's like they're going to make you pay a price for that. And that's been something continual that we've seen in the world of sports for way too long. I want to give another angle, though, on this that has to be said. And there's been so much talk about Deion in this. Shador never would have dropped if it wasn't for Deion. And there is something to the fact that Deion has been thought of as he'll be a coach in waiting for ever Shador gets drafted. And these NFL head coaches are so insecure about their jobs because there's no salary cap for coaches. So, you know, all right, if you're a multi-billionaire and you want to fire somebody and owe them $20 million still to get Deion Sanders to coach his son Shador, you know, that was a fear that lurked. And I was counting them on one hand, the number of NFL coaches who are honestly secure in their jobs. And one of the things they all had in common was that they all had quarterbacks, which shouldn't be surprising because, you know, that's the most important position. So if you're, you know, McDermott over, I almost said Doug McDermott, who's a basketball player. But if you're McDermott over in Buffalo, well, you've got Josh Allen. You're secure in your job, but you've got Josh Allen, Andy Reid, Patrick Mahomes. So the insecure coach aspect is a part of this. And then one last thing I want to say, because that's less racist and more about, you know, all these dudes, including, I think, Mike Tomlin, actually feeling like, I don't want Deion breathing down my neck if I draft Shador high. Now that he's in the fifth round, you know, the Deion question goes away, which I think is one of the reasons why what happened. I'll also just add really quick, he's on the perfect team for himself and will be starting by game 8. And I will bet anybody that amount of money that that's going to take place. Dude is pro and ready. Let's get that part out of the way first. He should have been at first and at worst the second quarterback taken late in the second round. The one last thing I'll say, because I know I've been filibustering and I apologize, is that one of the critiques I heard, and I've been listening to all the podcasts, is someone who's like an insider said he was terrible in the interviews because these other kids are coming up poor. And they look at Shador and say, this guy grew up with money. He doesn't want this as bad. He's cocky and all the rest of it. I don't remember them ever saying that about Peyton or Eli Manning. You know, he's, you know, like a lot of, particularly at the quarterback position, a lot of these guys do come in with families, with resources, all the rest of it. But Shador being black and not being willing to just like, you know, they think, oh, well, this guy isn't just going to kill himself for us because he has resources. I mean, how racist is that if you think about it? And then often, and it's particularly racist because even if we have questions about Shador's mobility and arm strength, one thing you cannot question is his heart and his willingness to take a terrible beating on that field behind what was called the worst offensive line in college football. So that's what I mean when I say there are a lot of factors to this. I mean, they wanted to humble him for multiple reasons. Coaches, who I would be loath to call racist but were very scared of Deion, was a part of the equation. And he got caught in it in an unprecedented way, because it's like, okay, they want to humble him, so I guess he'll be picked in the second. And then it's like the fifth? I mean, that's some next level galaxy brain thing to have happen that nobody predicted. That's all I'll say.
That was Dave Zirin. I'm going to come back to you, Byron. And I appreciate those layers and levels. There's a lot to think about, and I appreciate the historical reminder that anybody who stands up and they are proud, especially when they're black, they get, you know, the Muhammad Ali tag. And then 50 years later, we all love him. You know, everybody loves Muhammad and forget that he was demonized. He was a victim of respectability politics by some black folks who felt that he should, you know, calm it down and tone it down. And he was the victim of outright racism of people who wanted to see him get bashed in the mouth. And he was often compared, like, why can't you be like Joe Louis, the Bronx, you know, somebody who's a little bit more humble. I want to come back to a couple of things, Byron, and toss this to you. One, the thing about fatherhood, which I think is extremely important. We often have heard, well, we're the daddies, you know, we're the fathers. And Shador Sanders has a daddy who's there for him. And we're in a league where I know for a fact that our Niners, you know, right here, if Colin Kaepernick was still around, there would have been a problem, not with Kyle Shanahan, but Mike Shanahan, his daddy, the legendary coach who is good friends with Trump and who has a presence to this very day on the field, right? We know about the Mannings that Dave Zirin mentioned. We know all throughout sports that the owners put their sons into key positions, that we have legendary figures who are on the field that are connected because, you know, they're the offspring. So we should be celebrating, I would think, the presence of this father who raised a kid who had no problems, you know, who having no controversy around him. And now he's demonized. He's seen as somebody that is just problematic. And then I'm looking at all the other fathers all the way down from Serena and her father, you know, in tennis, to the basketball father. I'm forgetting his name.
LeVar Ball. LeVar Ball.
The Ball fathers. So now when you show up and you have a strong presence as a daddy, meaning that you're not going to let your son get bamboozled because he has generational wealth and knowledge, in the case of Shador, that seems to be a problem. So that's one aspect. And the other aspect is if they have a problem with arrogance, almost all those owners supported the most arrogant person you can think of. Donald Trump paid for his, you know, everything and seemed to have no problem with arrogance there. But I'll toss this to you and have you weigh in on some of that.
Yeah, well, you know, I briefly touched on, you know, some of the historical stereotypes that exist that were created not by black people, but for black people. And in this case, for black men. And the one stereotype that I did not mention is the deadbeat dad, which is another stereotype that exists about black men. And it's a stereotype that Deion Sanders defies, right? LeVar Ball also defies that stereotype. And so knowing and understanding that that Shador Sanders comes out of a home, a family in which there is a strong black male figure who has advocated for all of his children, but particularly his two children that have played football for him at Colorado and before that Jackson State. I think it makes NFL owners and coaches more wary. And I think Dave, you know, spoke about this, you know, brilliantly a moment ago, that it makes NFL coaches more wary that this is a player that they cannot control, that they cannot manipulate, especially considering the fact that the father, Deion Sanders, is a Hall of Fame football player, right? So he understands the game. He understands, you know, how professional football works. He understands, you know, the power, and does not accommodate himself or make himself small in the face of NFL owners or NFL coaches. And so I think what they see in Shador is someone who is fortified in a way that other athletes, black athletes, are not. And I think that whether it's spoken or unspoken, I think it presents a challenge, and a challenge that, you know, owners and coaches didn't necessarily want to face. And I think it's the fact that Shador is a black quarterback. He's not the only and the first black quarterback to play in the NFL, but he is a black quarterback who, again, defies a certain stereotype about black men. He doesn't capitulate. You know, he doesn't change who he is. He doesn't conform to what a quarterback is supposed to be. You know, he is unapologetically himself. He speaks the way that he speaks. He doesn't feel or act desperate, like he has this desperate need for belonging in the NFL. And so, again, that counted, that was a knock against him, when the only thing that should have mattered is what Dave talked about, was his athletic skill on the football field, his ability to win games, right? To build programs, to help build programs, to make them better, to compete at the highest level, and to be, you know, an elite quarterback at a high level at the University of Colorado. So I think all of these things, like these things are not being discussed and talked about in mainstream right. at all. I mean, you know, they're talking about the interviews. They're talking about, you know, whether or not he's a tier one elite player or something less than that. They're talking about all these different things, but the nuanced aspect of race in America and as it relates to black men specifically is not really being discussed with any real level of, I would say, nuance or sophistication.
Right. Well, you said a couple of things, Byron, and I want to build on that a little bit. You said make himself small.
Yeah.
Which I think is, and maybe you could share your own personal experience with that. You talked about the quarterback who by default becomes the face of the franchise, right? Which means that, you know, you're going to see this individual's face all the time, right? Yeah. And the third thing within that is when you describe somebody who's unapologetic and they're just themselves, oftentimes that's lauded. This is an adventurous, this is a confident, this is a self-thinker. All these type of accolades go to somebody like that. We need to nurture that spirit and lift it up if, you know, but when it comes to us, it's demonized and criminalized because you're not going to conform. But this making yourself small is something that has been drowned into a lot of folks to say, make yourself feel less threatening. Make yourself, you know, make sure that everybody feels comfortable. You know, we're told that when we're around the cops, like, don't you speak up, you know, keep your hand on the wheels. So let's build with that, because that's why I think this caught a lot of people's attention.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier the support that many of these NFL owners gave Donald Trump, right? Despite his arrogance, his confidence, and really delusional confidence, and his you know, completely, you know, inflated self, sense of self, and his ego. That's acceptable for white men, especially white men who have money and white men who have power. Black men are not necessarily given that same latitude. And I think it's important to make distinctions about, you know, the position that Shador plays. He does play quarterback, which by definition is a leadership position, the face of the franchise, potentially the face of the franchise if you become the team's starting quarterback, certainly. And so there's a very particular way in which NFL owners and coaches expect their quarterbacks to present themselves, to lead, right? Think of Russell Wilson, for example, right? You know, Russell Wilson, you know, has a very different demeanor and very different persona than does Shador Sanders, right? And other quarterbacks, you know, in the league. you know, he's much more refined, you know, much more respectable. And I'm not saying this in a negative way about Russell Wilson. I mean, I love Russell Wilson, but Shador is he's almost like the exact opposite of that, you know, when it comes to his personality. And he's a great kid. I mean, my understanding is that he's done well in school. He has not had any off the field problems. You know, he's never been arrested in the same way that Baker Mayfield was arrested in 2017. He was arrested for public drunkenness and attempting to flee the police just before the NFL draft in 2018, where he was selected number one overall by the same team, the Cleveland Browns, right? Could you imagine if that had happened to someone like Shador Sanders? I mean, he would have gone undrafted, right? If he went around. So, you know, black athletes have black male athletes have the range and the latitude to be confident and arrogant and aggressive if you play defensive end or linebacker, but at quarterback, it's a very different sort of expectation, you know, that comes along with that. And I've had to play that myself as a quarterback. I have had to sort of play that role of being the spokesperson for the team, you know, of making sure that I speak well and that I, you know, I represent the university well, right? And to not cause or create any controversy, right? Because that could somehow jeopardize my position on the team or what have you. And I think that black quarterbacks know that, right? And so they perform a certain kind of black masculinity. And because Deion Sanders has given his son so much confidence to be who they are and to walk in their power, he doesn't feel the need to, he meaning Shador, doesn't feel the need to do so. And so I think that that's troubling and challenging on in a particular and maybe even a nightmare that NFL coaches want to avoid.
Appreciate that.
Before we go, there's one last angle that we have to explore.
What's that?
That we have to explore, that we can't ignore. It's almost an elephant in the room because it is also very elucidating. Donald Trump likes to collect black athletes who are, you know, have big media platforms and are willing to say that he is their friend. You know, like this is he likes to collect these. Lawrence Taylor, Daryl Strawberry. They're all from that era where Donald Trump would be partying with these guys, you know, much more so than young black athletes. And Donald Trump stepped in after the first day to be like, my good friend Deion's son, Shador, hasn't been drafted. This is an outrage, like, you know, a distraction move. He's using his bully pulpit to do this while he's arresting young people and pulling them off the streets and putting them in El Salvador in prisons or detention centers in Louisiana. Like, the distraction stuff has gotten so tired by this point. But it says something that these NFL owners have bankrolled Donald Trump. And yet even a friendship with Donald Trump is not going to have them get over the fact that Shador is young and black and has, as they put it, an attitude, which I would just call supreme confidence, which is, I thought you wanted your quarterback to have that. I thought you wanted your quarterback to be an alpha. Isn't that what they always tell us? And I just think that that's a very interesting angle, that the Trumpian aspect, you know, I'm sure the coaches looked at that and were like, oh, Christ, more of a distraction. If he's not starting by game three, we might have to hear from the damn president, who, by the way, could arrest me and pull me off the street and put me in a van. But it says something yet again about how, like, the billionaires behind the scenes really do run Trump, and people think it's vice versa. But here's Trump, like, basically trying to order these billionaires to draft Shador Sanders, and they're just looking at him and like, man, just shut the bleep up and brutalize the people we want you to brutalize.
Well, that could have also just been, you said, a distraction move. It's also a tactic in which is like, you can signal to people, well, you know, I tried, You know, we say Donald was cool. He tried to get Sador, signed. So he's not that bad. And I think what he realizes is that we as black folks sometimes live vicariously through the actions of those who are most visible. So the reason why we're even having this discussion is because within our community, many of us saw a little bit of ourselves in Shador. And I think it wasn't so much that owners thought that Shador would be humbled, because he comes from money. He has Dion as his dad. He'll be all right at the end of the day. People will say, he's a millionaire. What are you worried about? I don't know if we in the public would be all right, because I think it's a humbling of us. When our heroes fall, a little bit of us fall sometimes. And I think that's known. And that's what I think was also a message. Like, I'm going to put all these people in their place, and we're going to do this very publicly. So Shador is humbled, quotations around that. But at the same time, we just seen the takedown of Shannon Sharp. You know, we can say he inflicted it on himself, but it's a very public takedown. And we can go on and on and on. Meanwhile, you have owners, you know, that you better not say anything about their indiscretion. I'm talking about Robert Kraft. Somebody made a joke about him, and Tom Brady was ready to, you know, mop somebody off the floor for that, right? Jerry Jones, they were able to wipe his involvement with segregationist acts, you know, off the screen when it was shown, when it came up last year. So these owners are bigger than life personalities, and, you know, there's accommodation for them. And to the point that I think Byron was saying, that they're representing the team, but these owners sometimes outshine and represent the team, using Jerry Jones as an example. I don't know if that's making sense. It just seems like part of this was to send a message to the masses, you know, that we need to be humbled and that we need to feel a certain way about seeing people who we admire be put in place.
You know, there was something about this. You know, as I was watching, I was not watching the draft live. I was actually working, and I was just sort of paying attention. I was really curious to know when Shador was going to go, and I fully expected him to go in the first round, if not early second round. But I fully expected him to go in the first round. There was something about this that felt like public shaming, public humiliation. And really trying to make Shador pay for who he was, right? And if this is something that was that's really unspoken, it's unsaid. But I know for black, and I think this is part of like why so many black people have been responding the way that we have been, because it feels so familiar. There's no concrete evidence. Right. You know, there's, you know, people have been talking about these interviews that he did not do, or that he performed really poorly in interviews. And some have speculated that these have been rumors that have been circulated to hurt or to devalue Shador's value in the draft. But it just, for us as black people, it just feels so familiar. It feels like Colin Kaepernick, you know, it feels like situations where it just feels unjust. It just doesn't feel right. And we know that he's certainly not a fifth round draft pick. We know that, right? So what is it? Were his interviews really that bad? I mean, he's the son of an NFL he's the son of an NFL player and a head coach. His football IQ has to be off the charts. He's been able to navigate, you know, football fields, you know, all of his life. So all of a sudden you have concerns about his ability to think and to speak in an interview. That it just doesn't add up. It just doesn't line up. But what does make sense is that this is a part of a system that is designed to break young, confident black men down, right, and put them in their place. That's what feels familiar to black people,
right? So that makes the point that this is a message to us as well.
Exactly. You know,
because at the end of the day, Shador will go home and be okay, but Byron Hurt and Davey D and a bunch of other folks, we got to go to work. proverbially speaking, and we have the water cooler conversation. And all of a sudden, you feel like you are the representative because you are the only one in the room. So by default, you feel like, okay, you know, what you say needs to really represent more than just my humble opinion, but, you know, you're speaking on behalf. I mean, we all felt a certain way about Kaepernick because, as you said, it was familiar, but it's familiar because we experience these things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the message is, well, if they can do this to Kaepernick, they can do this to me, right? And so if Kaepernick was outspoken and he was, you know, brave enough to speak out against social injustice and police brutality, and he was exiled from the league, well, then that means I could lose my job too. You know, I posted the other day that, you know, a reminder that public lynchings were not just to, you know, to lynch and maim you know, that particular black male, right, or black woman. The message was being sent far and wide to the community, right, that this could happen to you, right? And I'm not comparing what happened to Shedeur Sanders as a public lynching, as a lynching, right? But what I'm saying is that the messaging feels very, very similar. It's the remnants of that are real, right? And so I don't want to dismiss what so many African-American football fans are feeling in this moment.
I say one thing real quick.
Sure.
One of the things that Byron Hurt just hit upon that's worth saying is, of course, we're not using the word lynching, but the part about spectacle being a part of this is very important to the NFL. You know, the three of us talk about Colin Kaepernick because for us, that's like yesterday. You know, that's the fight that amplified a lot of our work. Certainly with me, that's the case. We sometimes, I think, need to take a step back and be like, wow, Colin Kaepernick was 9 years ago, which means the people coming into the league right now who are 21, I mean, what is their memory of that at age 12 playing youth football? You know, how do they actually, how did they process that? How did they process 2020, which was 5 years ago? Which is a lifetime at that age. So to me, this was also about the NFL owners being like, we need a new spectacle because we've achieved Colin Kaepernick becoming, and I know this from talking to players, from becoming a ghost story of like, you better not act out or you can be like Colin Kaepernick and just be gone. Goodbye, $100 million contract. You're just gone because you dared speak out about politics that offend both the ownership and our white fan base. Now you go to this though, this is the spectacle for 2025. And that's what they wanted. They needed another spectacle. And from now on going into the draft, especially going into the interview, this is gonna last a generation of saying to young people, you don't be Shedeur Sanders. The same way they would say, don't get capped, being like Kaepernick. Yeah. They're gonna say, don't get Shedeured. Because, you know, in other words, go in, you know, really bowing and scraping into these interviews. And you better have an agent. They hate the fact that Shedeur didn't have an agent. You know, don't let your family, you know, they did this to Lamar too. For goodness sakes, the Ravens almost got rid of Lamar Jackson. And their big complaint, this is Lamar Jackson. I know I'm a Ravens fan, but it still boggles my mind that the Falcons could have had him at quarterback for like, for nothing. They just decided.
Yeah, but think about Lamar Jackson. I mean, he's another really good example. I mean, he was outside of, you know, the image of what you want your franchise quarterback to look like and act like. And you know, for many weeks, you know, leading up to that NFL draft, and I'm talking about Lamar Jackson's draft, they were talking about changing his position to receiver, right? You know, I mean, they were actually questioning his ability to play quarterback in the NFL. You know, and so again, just going back to like what the NFL quarterback symbolizes. And again, I just want to go back to what Shedeur Sanders represents in this time, in this era. You know, and I'm glad that you referenced the time frame the time that has elapsed between Colin Kaepernick and Shedeur Sanders. Shedeur Sanders represents something very different here. I mean, he's part of that NIL generation of athletes who they're like wealthy as college athletes now, right? And therefore they are more empowered, right? They don't need when I say they, I'm talking about athletes who are like high level elite athletes no longer need money in the same way that they did when they were poor and broke and their only ticket out was the NFL, right? And so again, there's something about this need to humble, to put someone in their place, to say, look, we are the ones who control you. You don't control us. We control you. So let's get that straight before you begin your NFL career. And you know, if you get that message, then we'll be okay.
So, Byron, this is what I was getting at. I wish I could articulate it the way that you just did. This humbling, well, it used to be called put uppity Negroes in their place. So there was the brute, there was the coon, there was all these stereotypes, but then there was the uppity one. And as quiet as kept, when we heard about lynchings, they didn't lynch JoJo down the street for his, you know, being animalistic. They usually lynched the people that they saw most threatening, which were uppity blacks. Wait a second, you own a business? You're economically fit? You can do for self, right? You're pulling yourself up by your bootstraps? Well, let's bomb your city, Tulsa. Let's take out Rosewood. Let's destroy Atlanta. You know, we have a whole history of folks being really upset about uppity blacks. And there's a whole legacy about black folks coming back from World War II, you know, who were proud and sure of themselves and able to look you in the eye and didn't want to fall into those stereotypes. So that became the issue of putting the uppity black into the place. And I know you got to bounce. So before I continue with Dave, let me let you get some last thoughts on that, because that's what I was trying to say.
Well, you know, I think I appreciate this conversation because I think it's a real conversation. And I think that we're talking about the elephants that are in the room, and we're calling a thing, as opposed to trying to make sense of it by talking about, you know, his interviews and, you know, his whether he's like a, you know, elite one quarterback versus an elite two quarterback, or however you want to frame it. This is important stuff, because, you know, we're living in an era right now where black and brown history is being erased. I mean, they're literally taking artifacts out of the African American History Museum, right? So this idea of erasure, or this sort of minimizing of black symbolism, black importance, black significance, black history, I think it's a really appropriate conversation to be having during these times. And I thank you for allowing me to be a part of the conversation. And of course, Dave Zirin is insightful as always.
Thank you.
You have any projects coming out, Byron, that we should be on the lookout for?
I have one project called Men of Courage, which features five African-American and Latino men in the state of New Jersey who are working to disrupt gender-based violence in their local neighborhoods. It just got selected for a film festival, which I have not announced yet, but that's the project I'm working on right now.
Congratulations on that, and thank you for sharing your wisdom, brother. We appreciate
you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So that was Byron Hurt, filmmaker, and we appreciate him coming on. Dave Zirin still with us as we're getting ready to wrap up. Dave, when you brought up a point about how the owners were creating spectacle, the thing that came to mind was people forget, but institutions always remember. And we got to institutionalize our experiences. We got to institutionalize our understanding of history, which is why they're erasing history. Otherwise, we wind up repeating it. And so, yeah, I think you made an excellent point in bringing up the fact that, yeah, 2020 is like, I remember it like yesterday, but for somebody who was 14 to 15, they may not, you know, or 13, if they were coming into the league at 18 or whatever. It may be, like you said, a lifetime away. And institutions have a way of, as you said, reminding people while simultaneously making sure they don't have what I would call generational knowledge. And I think the biggest threat to this whole thing is that Shedeur Sanders and others like him have generational knowledge, meaning you can't fool them. You can't run game on them. Their daddy is there, not physically, but has also armed them with information. And I think that's the thing we got to watch out for, is the separating of institutional knowledge in our community and either distorting it, erasing it, or demonizing it, so that we don't go anywhere near it. And I'll close with this. Just listening to the interview the other day with filmmaker Ryan Coogler, and he was talking about some of the scenes that he had put in the movie were the way to undemonize practices and understandings that have long existed in our folks, you know, throughout the diaspora, that have been something like, we don't throw beads on the table, we don't walk down the crossroads at night, we don't play this music because it's devil's music, and then unpacking it and saying, well, these things were held sacred in our community, but now they're demonized. And this seems to be a pattern in which we try to keep people in the dark about, you know, everything from culture to just basic information on how things operate. And so to your point, I think this was a perfect example. The institution is like, let's make sure they don't have any knowledge of these past heroes and sheroes. Their memory should be who got Kaepernick, or in this case, who got Shadored.
Yeah, and Davey, one thing that also I think is a big tell that we haven't talked about yet is the media ownership dynamic, because Dion is a media made guy, you know, worked at the NFL Network for years. You know, he hasn't played in several decades. So, you know, most of that time has not been coaching. It's been doing media work. And the media guys, and this is the first thing I want to say, the media guys who know Dion, love him.
Right.
And it says something to me. First of all, I think their love of Dion gave them the ability to look at Shadur with open eyes. Because, and, you know, and I'm talking about media members who you could even argue are white and who have maybe even histories of some racial BS. Because right. You know what that's like very well. It's like, oh, he's not black, he's Dion. You know, that approach of things. So they're able to see Shadur as Shadur, not as young, black, cocky quarterback, because a lot of them have even known Shadur since he was born, literally.
Right.
Through knowing Dion in the media circles. Now, what about the NFL ownership circles? What do they see? They may see Dion and Shadur as well, not just as black this, black that. But who is Dion as a black man? He's the guy who turned Colorado into a pro program, giving them all kinds of headaches. You know, he's the guy who isn't humble, and they hate that from a black athlete. And he imbued that sense of empowerment to his son. So you had more than I had ever seen, ever, a split between the media analysis of Shadur. And let us please not forget, this isn't the media of the old days where they're getting all their cues from the general managers. A lot of the media, and yes, I do have serious criticisms of this, but that's a whole separate conversation. But a lot of the media are ex-players and coaches. So these ex-player instead of journalists, that's a whole separate conversation. But one thing these ex-coaches and players know is talent and the ability to assess talent. So their perspective, which was largely unencumbered by racism, was, oh, he's a first rounder, worst case scenario, Pittsburgh at 21, they got Aaron Rodgers in their pocket, so he'll slide to early second. That was the worst case scenario. So fifth round, I mean, to me, it just speaks to the incredible gap between the institutionalized racism of the NFL and a media that knew Dion as Dion and Shadur as Shadur.
Great point, Dave Zion. I'll just close with this. Dion, Shadur has money. So he doesn't have the same desperate, you know, vibe that others may have. But him going to fifth round means that he might make maybe $1 million. He'll be like Brock Purdy, right? you get a cheap on the deal versus somebody who goes in the first or second round. Well, that could be 10 or 15 mil. You know, you could be up there. So, you know, somebody who doesn't come from means like Deion, but has, you know, confident attitude, that's where the humbling starts, to your point. It's like, Deion be all right. I mean, the Sanders will be all right. But you, Davey D, you know, coming from South Bronx, you might not be all right. So you better humble yourself. You know, somebody who's trying to get into this thing, you better be quiet, because that could cost you 10 or 15 mil, you know. And I think that's the message. You know, be humble, or, you know, or we'll punish you. And we'll use, you know, this high profile, well-connected, beloved individual as the you know, proverbial whipping boy to remind you. And that's something that needs to change, or at least we need to recognize that for what it is, and hold people who put somebody in that position accountable to the best of our ability. Dave Zirin, let me let you get the last word and let people know how they can get a hold of you, and also thank you for doing the show.
Oh, you're welcome. The one last thing I would add is, while you're right that while the Sanders have money, it's like, we really do need to remember that Shador is the gym rat of all gym rats. He had the worst offensive line in the game last year in college, and he took hit after hit after hit while putting up incredible stats. Like, I think he's utterly humiliated right now and really, really, really upset. So he is paying a psychological price for what took place. And now, and that's utterly, to me, unacceptable. And it got cruel after a while. And we're going to now see what happens from here, whether this would be something that defines his career in the positive, like Tom Brady going 199th and he uses it to motivate him forever, or if this derails him. Like, it so totally derailed a quarterback named Brady Quinn, who was a top prospect who slid down the draft board, and before you knew it, his confidence was shot. I really hope for the former. Or someone like Geno Smith, who took like 5 years to get his confidence back after he fell on the draft board, but he did get it back. But it does derail you. So now we're going to see what Shador can do in this difficult context, because I promise you, it means more to him than dollars and cents.
Real talk. And, you know, Dave Zirin, tell everybody how we can get a hold of you.
Well, just first and foremost, Davey, I mean, I'll always drop anything to record with you, because you do it like nobody else. If people want to catch up with me, I'm at Edge of Sports on all sorts of media platforms, except for X, Twitter, Nazi Land, whatever. I'm off of that. But I'm very easy to find. So Edge of Sports, check it out, blah, 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 The Nation magazine.
And as you close out, I forgot to mention the son of a defensive coordinator, you know, is all up in the mix. You know?
Oh, we didn't even talk about that.
Yeah, playing a prank, a cruel prank, making these false phone calls in the draft, violating all sorts of rules. And to our knowledge, he got a slap on the wrist. He was just a mischievous, you know, 23-year-old.
Yeah, he's gonna get his slap in the face in the schoolyard. So, you know, slap on the fist if he must. Give me a break. I mean, I would never wish violence on someone, but there are other ways to give somebody a slap on the wrist. Is all I'm gonna say.
We're gonna take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
They sold us dreams, then broke them down. Shipped our jobs to another town. Said tariffs gonna make us great. But all we got is higher rates. Hey, ew, backlash blues. Same old play, tricking folks while they fade away. History told us how this ends. Gotta rise up, can't play pretend.
Backlash blues.
what you gonna do? Backlash blues, what you gonna do? Hey, Reagan whispered, Trump just shouts. Tearing it down, no fear or doubt. They kill the deal, erase the past. Keeping white folks rich while we fall fast. Oh, backlash blues, same old play. Tricking folks while they fade away. History told us how this ends. Gotta rise up, can't play pretend.
Backlash blues,
what you gonna do, baby? Backlash blues, what you gonna do?
this is Daffodil. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland.
Got troubles.